Project Sapien is a podcast meant to engage our brothers and sisters in the law enforcement and military communities in conversations we all know we need to have. All opinions you hear are our own and are protected by the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. They in no way reflect or are meant to reflect the opinion of any specific agency, officer, or service member. Some opinions may be controversial. Listener discretion is advised. Everybody, Project Sapient,
number one law enforcement military podcast, is back. Huge thanks to our tens of thousands of listeners. We heard you and we are back for season three, people. Not just back, we're bringing the heat this season, brother. It would not be possible without our partners and supporters. AAA Police Supply, our law enforcement listeners, you're looking for a one-stop shop for supplies and duty gear, you need to look no further. Head over to AAAPoliceSupply.com. Use the code HYBRID10 for 10% off every single order you make. We also want to thank our friends over at the Havoc Journal, the voice of the veteran community, focusing on current affairs and articles of interest to the public in general and the veteran community specifically. For independent news that gets to the facts about everything from geopolitics, science and tech, finance to corporate, contemporary affairs and entertainment, head over to HavocJournal.com, as well as our good friends there and partners at the Profiles in Havoc podcast. We also want to thank the Second Mission Foundation for educating, elevating, and advocating for our service community, helping them find their second mission after government service. Head over to secondmissionfoundation.org for more info, as well as our good friends at 22 Mohawks. They're combating the veteran suicide epidemic by providing assistance to veterans needing help navigating the reentry into the civilian world when they return home from duty. Learn more at 22mohawks.com. We also want to thank our good buddy Kyle Lamb and Viking Tactics, the best tactical gear anywhere. From battle belts to slings and everything in between, Kyle's company offers an elite selection of high-quality, battle-proven tactical gear guaranteed to be ready when you need it every single time the job calls for it. Check them out at VikingTactics.com. And we also want to thank our friends over at the Overwatch Project. We all know that suicide can and often is an impulsive decision, and firearms are the most lethal tool there is. Overwatch Project aims to put some time and distance between our person in crisis and that tool by just fucking asking the question. Do you have a plan for your firearms when you're in that dark place? Can we make one together? And will you be my buddy and help me with the same? Head over to overwatchproject.org for more information on how to form workable plans of action and how to just fucking ask. Iman, brother, dude, I'm so pumped for this season. We are starting off with a banger today.
Absolutely. We've got a very special guest, Mike Malpass. If, for those who don't know who he is, Mike is recently retired police officer with 30 years of experience as a patrol officer, SWAT operator, defensive tactics instructor, and he retired out of Phoenix PD. He teaches a combination of physical training and tactics with the neuroscience of sound decision making under stress for real world encounter. So Mike has written two books. All right, first one today, which we'll talk about, is Taming the Serpent. The neuroscience behind police training. And then the second one is going to be Fall 7, Rise 8, a Kaizen approach to law enforcement training and life. And he also has a training company called Combative Resolutions. Check him out at combativeresolutions.com. Hey, Mike, how you doing, man?
I'm doing fantastic. How you guys doing?
Great. Glad to have you here.
I appreciate the chance to... for you to hear the ramblings of an old man.
You know, those ramblings tend to have a lot of kernels of wisdom in them. And if people aren't listening, it's because they're not smart enough to. So we're happy to have all of your experience. And, you know, to think about 30 years in the field, I mean, quite frankly, that's longer than some of the patrol officers have been alive. So if they're not listening, they need to up their game.
Well, just Mike, the ramblings of an old man. I'm going to be the old man who sits outside in a rocking chair with a shotgun telling all the kids to stay off my grass. So that's all I'm going to be doing. I always tell my wife, I'm going to be that guy looking for that electric scooter on the shopping center just so I can run people over. that's my contribution as an old man.
as long as you got a plan.
Yeah. Right. Mike, so a while ago, the way I kind of got to know you is through a mutual friend of ours. Jason Shea, who, you know, director of, up here out in, Massachusetts, for training. And he was the one who really got me to read your book, because me and him were talking about how, you know, we've been developing, myself, Jake, and our third stooge, I'll call him. we've developed this sort of training program where I was thinking, I think I kind of told you the history of it, where, you know, I just looked around at our training and kind of this light bulb went off. We're like, you know what? We're not really training. We're just, you know, for patrol officers, I mean, SWAT and other specialty units are a little different, but for patrol, your everyday patrol officer, they're not really training. They're just doing the check the box versus actually really testing themselves, you know, holistically as a profession. You know, we do these in service, we do this, we do that. It doesn't really do much. And when I got to talk to Jason about it, and we kind of, I just went through the whole neuroscientific approach. That's when he said, "Oh, then you need to talk to Mike." And I said, "Well, who is Mike?" And, you know, sent me your book and, you know, sent me the link to your book, and I bought it and I read it in 1 week, dude. That's how into it I was. Literally, it was for me. I'm a sort of nerd with this stuff. Jake is also. And I sent it to Jake. Jake read it also. And Jake, you probably got the same feeling I got in terms of nerding out on the book.
Yeah, no question. I mean, Mike, you did a remarkable job of kind of coalescing everything in and around this topic into one streamlined way of presenting it so that anybody that picks that book up can read it and understand it. You know, we get into the space of white papers and research, and which I tend to enjoy reading, but at the same time, that's kind of its own language and doesn't necessarily translate to the general community very well, let alone in this community. You don't talk down to anybody by any means. You just have a remarkable way of disseminating that information in a way that is consumable for everybody out on the street. How did you come to that? I would assume it would have something to do with, you know, 30 years experience and knowing how to talk to people, but how did you put all this together?
It actually started before I became a police officer. I was, I've been involved in competitive fighting since I was 13 years old. I fought boxing, kickboxing. I fought mixed martial arts, those early days of NHB. I had a few of those fights.
Nice.
And the big thing for me has always been fear and anger are two sides of the same coin. And for a fighter, there's this old axiom by the old fighters that there's three steps into the ring. Step one, I'm ready. Let's do this. Step two, stick to the game plan. Step three, what the hell was the game plan? And then you go.
And everybody's got a plan until they get hit in the face, right?
That's exactly right. And then, so after having that kind of experience and early on as a young fighter, I was very anger focused. I had to be angry. I had to be really assed up in order to fight. And I really had to be angry. And that worked really well in the novice divisions. And then when you moved up into the advanced divisions and against guys, the pro fighters, that anger didn't work so good for you when you fought someone who was slick. And in 1988, I fought in the National Kickboxing Championships, and 45 seconds into the first round, Lon Walls knocked me on my ass. And I got up on five. The referee asked a question and he must not have liked my answer, because that was the end of my day. And it was the most humiliating experience of my life, but it's also the best lesson I've ever learned in my life, because from that loss, I was like, okay, now the answer is I've got to learn how to manage the fear, the anxiety. And then, so you fast forward, I spent years doing that. And then I decided at 21, I was too immature to become a cop. And I think that's one of the smarter decisions I've made. I did more competitive fighting then, worked more training, got with some great people to help me prepare for the job. But then I get on the job and I go through the basic academy in Ohio, and it was a good academy, don't get me wrong, but it's just like the academy in Phoenix, where the defensive tactics program leaves a little bit to be desired. It's not that anybody means any harm in what they're doing, but it's so cookie cutter. If you're taking techniques from sports that have weight divisions, why are you teaching the same techniques to everyone? Why are you teaching a 130-pound kid
right.
to fight like a 250-pound man? It doesn't make any sense. So that's the next question was, all right, how do you redesign this? And by the time you leave that academy, you're like, okay, I understand how a gun works. We shot. I know how to hit the target, but they don't do a lot to get you ready for the valence and arousal that happens when you are firing that weapon for real. And then the difference between the first shooting I was involved in and go a handful later, it's night and day. So how do you take that experience and not just give a subjective answer, because anybody can give a subjective answer. But the problem with that is you go and say, oh, that guy's a world champion and his subjective experience is that he's a great fighter and that's awesome. But if that person's a heavyweight and you're not, why are you trying to learn how to fight like them? So it was this idea. And then I got the idea about 15 years ago to start talking to some of the scientists. But unfortunately, 15 years ago, there wasn't a lot of neuroscience about what the difference is between how the brain is at rest, how it is when things are going really good for you, and what the brain is doing when you're under fear, anxiety, stress, and pressure in volatile, uncertain, chaotic, and ambiguous environments. So that became this study. And then about 7 years ago is when the science started coming out. I started talking to these different neuroscientists, and they're like, you really need to look into affective neuroscience so that you understand what the emotional load is, what it can do to the brain, and how it affects performance. And that was really the kickstart into, okay, I get it now. The drill, 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 let's just drill, isn't working. And there's a reason why it isn't working. And now we're starting to understand why. So it was this connection of some of the neuroscience. And I'm not the smartest guy in the world. I've been hitting the head a lot. I do have a degree in kinesiology. That was what I studied in college, was kinesiology. And I was really interested in the brain then. But neurochemistry threw me for a big old spin, and I was not very good at that part. But fast forward, and I'm now fascinated by it. So now when I read it, I'm focused. And as it turns out, as an adult, it's not like as a child, mere exposure is great. You can learn all kinds of stuff as a child by just being exposed to it. But as an adult, you need that focus and agitation. And it's specific that you have to have that agitation and then the focus in order for neuroplasticity to open up as an adult. That was the catalyst that said, okay, now let's start connecting these worlds. And then let's see if we can talk to people in all of the realms and not just defensive tactics and say, if you understand what the brain is doing under fear, anxiety, stress, and pressure, there's a better way, I think, to start designing some of these programs. And that's really what it came down to. And I'm by no means am I saying I have all the answers. What I'm trying to get everybody to do is start a research project that never ends. Because if you ever think you know everything, you're a danger to yourself and others. That's just the way it is.
Mike, I 100% agree. And the thing is, what I found fascinating is I go back into, you know, my kid as being a martial artist and growing up all the way through. And, you know, I was heavily invested in that. And, you know, I'll never forget my earliest fears when I was a kid was getting punched in the face. Right. And that was when I was in middle school. You know, we're starting sparring and I'm doing all this. And my sensei knew I obviously every kid has that fear. Right. That's just it's there. And what he did was tie a belt around me and tie a belt around my opponent. And we had maybe 3 feet of separation and that's about it. So I had no choice but to engage and to figure it out and to get over that fear or not get over the fear, work through the fear and use the moves that I'm supposed to be using to whether avoid a hit, to counter, to do what I need to do. And it got me conditioned to be in that space. So, you know, for me, that 3 foot gap that I leave with, even to this day, I still do it, right? Where, because that's where I'm comfortable in operating in, because I've been doing it since I was 10 years old, right? And, you know, bring it in as an adult. And that's the thing, what I found is, you know, especially when you say, you know, or when you wrote, one of the things I highlighted in your book is understanding the brain in conflict aids in comprehending how problems can occur and aid in developing strategies to prevent issues such as this key phrase here, lawful but awful incidents, which are, you know, you explain police incidents that are lawful but look horrible to the public and media and mistake of fact shootings and excessive force. So just you saying that alone, understanding your own brain, right? I mean, and that's the thing. That's what I tell everybody that, that I train at my department or other departments is everybody is different. There's no cookie cutter. Everybody, you know, every human out there reacts the same way under stress. I learned that way back when I went to war, right? You had some of the toughest guys beating their chest. All of a sudden, they never want to leave the base, right? So that's the thing. It's a huge, huge thing for me when I read stuff like that. And, you know, you highlighted a bunch of the research, which we're going to get into in a little bit. But that's personally like my biggest thing is just there's not enough in the law enforcement world talking about this stuff. You know, I mean, we just revamped, not we as in the state, revamped a lot of the in-service. And it was just like report writing 101 or what's another one? Legal updates, fine. I don't have a problem with legal updates because things change all the time. But when you go take a group of officers and all you're talking about is report writing for 8 hours straight, I mean, that to me, that's okay. We check that box. Or courtroom testimony. All right, we checked that box. You know, that's not the real training that law enforcement should be getting into. And even Jake was a prior police officer before he had an injury, but he even says, you know, back in his day when he went to the academy, you actually enjoyed your time, right, Jake?
Oh my God, I loved it. I feel fortunate. You know, Mike, I think I might have had a bunch of guys like you as my instructors because my experience in the academy, and this is well over a decade. I mean, it's getting up there. I don't even want to do the math anymore. It was not the cookie cutter experience. We had a bunch of veterans, guys been on the street in some pretty rough counties around here that were our lead DT instructors, our lead SIM guys, our combat guys, firearms guys. And it was, for lack of a better term, we were learning how to be real police officers. And it was, you know, box drills, stress inoculation, didn't have a tag on it yet because it was still, like you said, about 15 years ago, a little bit more. There wasn't really a lot of conversation around this, but they were doing it because it's what worked for them in their prior military experience. And it was a very paramilitary academy. I loved it. Box drills and the stress side, it was great because you don't, it sounds funny. And I was going to ask you this. You know, with the people that you work with, you come across, you know, you said you started out fighting with anger and rage and emotion, right? And then that sort of evolved into more complex higher order thinking and problem solving within that context. It sounds funny, but one of my favorite things to do, like when Iman and I are either we're training or we're working or even competing, is I really like that level of stress because you're so hyper-focused on the thing in front of you that everything else that is going on, like, did I do the laundry today? Did I pick up the right groceries that my wife put on the list? All this other bullshit is gone. And it's kind of a weird meditative state that it's like, I just have to read, react, respond to what's in front of me. And I really liked it. I mean, I that was my favorite thing. And, you know, you only know what you know with what you're exposed to. And that was my whole exposure coming out was like, this is what police training is. Great. Awesome. I felt like I had the greatest training in the world. I didn't know any different. Turns out I had like a really weird subsect of training compared to the vast majority of the officers across the country that just don't get that. And they're like, you've been doing this for how long? And you got this when? That's what, how, right? And for you guys, you know, when you were coming, I mean, I know you ran into a bunch of hurdles and roadblocks with this kind of stuff, but when for you was that kind of transition point to where maybe in like myself, you kind of got to like, ooh, this is fun. I actually really like the thinking process of this more than the emotional process.
Well, it was when I start as you go in. So 1988, I'm in the National Kickboxing Championships and I exited the National Kickboxing Championships pretty quickly. I was devastated. I mean, I really was. And my coaches had told me, you're going to take 2 weeks off. Don't come back for 2 weeks. And I couldn't do that. I needed to know what happened. So I went in and met with my coaches. We watched the tape. And it was interesting because one of my coaches was he wanted me to watch it, but he goes, I want you to narrate this as if you're not the one in there. So you're going to say Mike, you're going to say Lon, and I want you to narrate this fight and just tell me what you think is happening. And at about the 30-second mark, I'm like, all right, Mike's being hyper aggressive. It looks like he is trying to load up a left hook. And at about the 35-second mark, I remember going, ah, crap. And he stops the tape and he goes, what? And I go, Mike is thinking that his aggression is working Lon is giving him space, but Lon is about to take that space back. And he goes, and what is Lon going to do? I go, he's checking for the left hook. When he sees the left hook, he is going to throw a straight right hand or a power bomb overhand right. And to be perfectly honest, I didn't know which he did at the time because I was a little busy. And then 5 seconds, 10 seconds later, Mike comes forward and walked right into an overhand right and was deposited flat on his keister. And Sam goes, if you were to, when he was talking to me, he goes, if you were to describe your demeanor, what would you say? And I would say angry and hostile. And he goes, if you were to describe Lon's demeanor, what would you say? I go, laid back, like he was just getting ready to fix my sink. And he goes, yeah. There you go. And so here's what I learned and why this is so important. If you listen to nothing else I say today, here is the most important part. Valence and arousal. Valence, it's either very important, not so important, somewhere in the middle or a sliding scale. Arousal is either high or low, in the middle or on a sliding scale. Your body uses valence and arousal as a measure of how much energy you're going to need to do something. At the extremes of valence and arousal are your emotions. So when you feel an emotion, you're at the extremes of valence and arousal. At the extremes of valence and arousal, the brain tends to take the amygdala to communicate directly with the striatum to find a fast, not necessarily accurate, quickest answer to the problem, which is either usually fight, flight, approach, or avoid. The thinking part of you, the part of you that holds higher rules, your morality, the law, your administrative policies and procedures, or as Robert Sapolsky, the great scientist, says, the part of your brain that holds the part that says it's the hard thing to do, but it's the right thing to do, is up here in the prefrontal cortex. At the extremes of valence and arousal, the prefrontal cortex is not working very well. It's cut off. The amygdala is taking control. When you control the valence and arousal, the prefrontal cortex settles down the amygdala, and now your higher order rules, your ideas about how you want to do this, your tactics, your strategies, all of these things come into play. Now, when the brain is trying to figure this out, the brain is not reactive. We train it as if it is a stimulus response organism. It is not. The brain is a predictive organism. It is predicting how much energy is it going to cost? Have we done anything like this in the past? Based on your relevant personal history, can we do this? And if the answer is no, you're going to go into an avoidance behavior, you're going to run away. Avoidance behavior may just be pull your car over, slow yourself down. I'm not going to do it. Maybe I won't be the first then. It doesn't have to be completely running away, but it is an avoidance behavior. If you want to perform well under extreme fear, anxiety, stress, and pressure, you need to have your brain predict less fear, anxiety, stress, and pressure because it's not real. It's all an illusion created by your brain. So if you have less of that and your brain predicts less of that, you will perform better. What I learned after that fight, which is again, that loss was the greatest gift that was ever given to me, was each time I went back in, those things lessened until I got to the point where I was at step one and I was like, all right, we're ready, let's do this. And then I went to step two and I was like, stick to the game plan. And at step three, I was like, and this is the game plan. Yeah, and yeah. In we go. And that, when I became a cop, I'm like, okay, if we're talking about the extremes of fear, I'm about to enter a relationship, an intimate relationship with fear, anxiety, stress, and pressure, and I'm going to be carrying a gun. I might want to try to do the same things I did for that into this realm, and then let's see what we can do. And that involved putting simunition rounds in the freezer and freezing those things.
They hurt.
And then eye goggles only, throat protection only. Protect the baby maker, but everything else, you're taking hits. And in some cases, you're using tweezers to pull that stuff out of your skin. Yeah. But the answer was, when I started talking to some of the guys who had been in gunfights, it was, don't train as if you're shooting paper. Train as if you're engaging another human being who can think. And train as if you're engaging a human being who wants to live as badly as you do. Yep. And it was Jim Cirillo who I was lucky enough to go to a class with, and he had been in so many shootings with the Stakeout Squad in New York. And he was the one who's like, you need to do contested work with a gun, figure out how to do it. And at times it meant shooting pellets at each other because we didn't even have simunitions when I first got on the job. So we were shooting BB guns at each other and stuff, trying to figure out how not to get shot. That stuff hurts. I still have scars from some of that crap.
Pain is the ultimate teacher. I find it interesting the way that you articulate that in the book. And then also here is that the brain is not a reactive tool necessarily. You use the term memory mapping in the book. And I think if people could kind of redirect their way of thinking of what I'm doing right now is laying down pathways for a direction, right? There's a mountain or there's a, you know, some obstacle to cross in front of me. There's a lot of ways to get around and through that. And the more times I practice taking different paths around that obstacle, the more my brain's going to be able to go back to, oh, we have an associative relationship with this. We can identify, it might not be the exact same thing, but it is close enough. And that the brain does such a good job of making that logical gap jump where it's like, hey, we got a gap here, but I've got something kind of adjacent to this in my map. I'm going to just do that. And the more of those you have, the more patterns you lay down. I mean, you obviously say it perfectly, way better than I do. You're going to get to that end state of, oh, now I'm flowing in this situation as opposed to overwhelmingly reacting emotionally. And that's something that I think is really, really important. And people should read the book because you do a remarkable job of outlining it to where, you know, again, down the layman terms, people might get lost in the neuroscience, but I understand what a map looks like. I understand what coloring lines and running a route look like. And then, oh, well, now here's my, okay, let's make this route a little bit squiggly this way and go that way. And, you know, we're getting the same end state with the same shared experience, but we've got a different path to get there. And it's just something that I think is really huge in the way that you say that and articulate that, because again, it's a thinking person's game, right? I mean, you can't go in there as a cop, you know, badge heavy, thinking everybody's going to respect my authority. It ain't going to happen. You know, you're going to get punched in the face. And then where's your plan? You know, all three of us have seen it in training. You fall back to fight or flight, and that flight might be to run. But what we've seen is I'm out of tools. I'm in a situation, and they present their firearm and it's like, man, that might not be justified, but that's your flight mechanism. I'm panicked. I'm afraid. Here's my gun.
It was remarkable to see that too, Mike, during some of the trainings that we've held. And you see, you know, we purposely, just so the officers are aware of what it feels like to actually be in that panic mode. And it's a simple exercise that we do where it's, you know, you're in an uncomfortable position on the ground, you know, the opponent's on top of you. Then we say go, and your heart rate's up and you're not able to breathe and you're, you know, really struggling, trying to figure out a way out. And finally you're like, fuck it, grab my gun and boom. Now you're like, oh boy, you know, and we'd ask him, all right, how do you articulate your deadly force? Was there anything that he was doing? And we purposely tell the role player, no choking, nothing like that. Just make it very, 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 very difficult for them. And that's it. And it was great because I'm not going to name the agency just to, you know, because usually we don't name agencies, but at this particular agency, we had a Division I wrestler as a role player who was a cop there. Great, great dude. I mean, guy is massive,
too, by the way.
Yeah, guy is massive, yet he's got a huge gas tank, which means, you know, we had to really push him to get him to where we wanted him on certain scenarios. But as a role player for this thing, it was great. And he even said, and his supervisor, his sergeant that was there, they're both very good. Sergeant, I believe, is a purple belt jujitsu. Like, they're very, very experienced in the ground game. And even both of them were like, ooh. Said, well, how are you going to explain that one, bud? You know, like, how are you going to explain this shooting that you just did? Like you said, was it lawful but awful? But, you know, again, it's one of those things where you panicked and you wanted to end quickly. Therefore, you just decided to shoot. So those are the things that we look at, you know, what we're seeing when we train officers in this type of high stress, high inoculation type training that we put together. And it's funny how the story you said about where you watched the video with your sensei and you guys went over everything. And it reminds me before we went to war in a training that the Army with the Army. And I was a brand new NCO, brand new sergeant, right? So I had my own little fire team, all that good stuff. And our objective at the time was go hit this village and, you know, insurgents, all that stuff. It's a, you know, one big scenario. So we had to map it out, you know, do the patrol out, whole nine yards. We get there And man, when I tell you they threw everything at me because they wanted to see how I am as a leader under fire, right? Because now I got to get troop movements. I got to tell them I need this. I need this. Now we got to do this. I have to shoot back, you know? So they threw artillery simulators, guns, fire everywhere. Well, you know, they overwhelmed my senses so much that I just vapor locked. It was like, holy crap. And then like you, that's when I had that epiphany moment, so to speak, where it was like, yeah, I got to go in this with a completely clear mind. You know, yes, my heart rate's up, all this is going on, but like you said, the thinking part of the brain is what really needs to be active under those extreme stresses. Where now, every time I do a SWAT head, I send Jake my heart rate all the time to show him and all that. And I mean, it's cool to see. So when you know how it is before SWAT hit, you know, you're in the Bearcat, you're on your way there, you got the little butterflies, you're a little nervous, you know, you're doing kind of shaking it off. And typically what I do is I take, you know, box breathing. I take deep breaths, right? You know, when I hear the 1 minute out, I take a few deep breaths and then I settle right down. And you see it right in my heart rate where it peaks at like 150 just when we're about to hit the door. And then when I'm going through the house, it's dropping because that's the environment I operate in because that's what I'm comfortable in. And that's how I train. I train myself for that purposely for those types of things. And that's the thing where, you know, you even say during a fight, the brain prefers to default to an emotional side of the house, which that's what you were talking about, you know, in your early years of kickboxing, right? You use your emotions and procedure memory for the sake of speed and energy efficiency. And, you know, you even go, let's say a suspect violently resists arrest by attempting to strike the officer. An officer well-trained in defensive tactics will have procedural memory that allows them to fight on autopilot if there are no violations or expectations. For instance, if the suspect starts to reach, starts throwing punches and at the officer, but then suddenly reaches under their shirt into their waistband, there's a change in conditions which violates expectations. And once the cognitive system recognizes the change, ideally, we are looking for a trained procedural response of moving, drawing our weapon, and directing our eyes to the subject's hands. And these responses are ingrained in the procedural system through training. So if you want to explain to people about that procedural side, you know, procedural memory and how, in terms of training law enforcement, how is that attainable?
So the best science to date so far says, number one, you must train in a representative environment. So the environment must represent the skills that you're going to do in the real world, which is why, Look at range training. Range training is incredibly important. And then even competition shooting, important. It's building a skill. But the skill set is thinking with a gun in your hand, knowing when to use the gun, when to not use the gun. There's a separation there. And then your skill, your integration of skill sets is knowing the law, understanding that that if you miss those rounds, you are accountable for those rounds. So the representative environment is if your agency only trains on the range and you're not training with live people, then you are using an audible stimulus and you're timing yourself off an audible stimulus, which can be done in 200ths of a second. Unfortunately, your visual system cannot operate in 200ths of a second. So you're timing yourself to go off of an audible when in the real world, you're going to be going off of visual stimuli. So representative would be adding visual stimuli, preferably from live human beings. But even if you can't use live human beings, get some visual stimulus. And now you're going to understand that your timing is going to be slower. And because your timing is slower, it's probably a better idea to move your damn feet than it is to try to stand there and outshoot someone who's probably already pointing a gun at you. The subconscious brain is in the implicit system is where your procedural memories are. The implicit system is not looking for logic. So when you say something like, well, in real life, I'd move. I'm sorry. That's just not how it works.
No, it doesn't work.
In real life, common sense isn't going to be available to you unless you train all the time so that your valence and arousal is not high. So how your brain predicts is using your implicit bias system. This is where all of the people got it completely wrong. Shove the wrong idea down our throats.
And are you sure? I just had that class.
They had no idea what they were talking about.
Yeah,
it was amazing to sit through that class and have the students who went through mine, because I put on one for the city, And they're asking all of the right questions and looking at these people who are teaching. They're like, I don't understand what you're saying. And I'm like, what do you mean you don't understand the science behind this? Implicit subconscious bias, hunches about risk and reward. Your brain is an implicitly biased system. If you've read the books that say system one and system two, and even I started the explanation that way because it's simpler, but that's not how the brain works. Your brain doesn't play tennis where your subconscious system has it and then casts it off to your conscious and your consciousness puts it back. The two of them are working together. The trick is that if your valence and arousal are only moderate to moderately high, they're continuing to talk back and forth. If your valence and arousal are through the roof, the thinking higher order you is offline and it's looking for the fastest associated decision. And what the brain, it's interesting. In your head right now, who's ever listening, close your eyes and picture a gun. Just picture it. Picture it in the finest detail, whatever gun you want to picture, but let's make it a handgun for the sake of discussion. Right now, you can think and picture that gun in your head because the very same neurons that fire to show you a gun are the same ones you use to reflect and show yourself one. Under extreme fear, anxiety, stress, and pressure, your whole life is a controlled illusion. Under fear, anxiety, stress, and pressure, you may get an uncontrolled illusion, and that reaching for a gun, you swear you saw it. You swear it was a gun when it was a baggie of dope, when it was his cell phone, but your brain showed you gun, and they're not necessarily lying. Your brain has that power. When you dream at night, what do you see? You see reality. It sure as hell seems like reality until something weird happens, until the, you know, midget, naked midget on a tricycle comes into your dream. You go, oh, that's right. I'm dreaming. This is weird.
I'm in right? Tuesday night.
There you go.
I was just going to say.
So procedural memory is a prediction of the brain that in the past we've done this. And the good news is that if you train regularly in volatile, uncertain, chaotic, and ambiguous environments, your pattern recognition goes through the roof. So now it doesn't matter that you haven't seen it exactly or trained it exactly. Your brain is in communication. The higher order levels of your brain are giving input. Your subconscious brain is giving trained input. And this is how your brain decides what we're going to do. But it doesn't do it by saying, in logic, I would do this. When you watch a video of another cop doing something, you use the logical portions of your brain because you don't have any emotional involvement in it. And it's very easy to say, this is what I would do, or it's easy to type on a keyboard, this is what I would do. But the problem is when you're embedded in it, your valence and arousal are part of it. Your body is predicting how much energy you need. And if it doesn't have a very good reading of how much energy you need based on past experience, then it goes to the extremes of valence and arousal, which is going to lead to extreme of emotion, which is going to lead to extreme behavior.
So you highlight something extremely interesting there because, and you started off the very beginning of it with our reaction to, as most of us trained on the live fire side, reaction to sound. Not visual, right? We go off the beep, we go off the whistle, we go off the go call, we go off the, you know, present, whatever the command is. And what's interesting about that, and I'm kind of thinking about this in the way of, you know, our ROs or our training instructors that are listening to this episode, how they can kind of maybe start to, even at a basic level, maybe they can't change policy, they can't change the check the box stuff, but you know what you can do? You can implement a little bit of a tweak. And instead of going off the whistle, how about we go off a visual cue? How about we put a flag down that's on the, you know, on the rope pole. And as soon as the flag goes up, boom, now I'm going. Because we've had officers that we've talked to, both in training and with, you know, various different interviews and things that, you know, in an OIS, they didn't see anything. They heard, I heard the shot. I returned. And it was, they missed cues, just like you said, because they were so trained, like, you know, Pavlov's dog, like bell goes ding, I get treat. Bell goes ding, I produce handgun and fire on target. What happens when the bell doesn't make any noise, right? What happens when it's a visual, as you were saying? So right. A simple take home for that, you know, and again, what would be fascinating to see would be take these departments that don't have a choice, but the cookie cutter, check the box, run your check the box training with your beeper or your whistle or whatever it is, note your times, then do the exact same drill, but make it a visual cue and watch what that gap is. And then the goal is not going to be that you're going to get the visual cue down to the auditory, because that's just not physiologically possible. The goal be, can we close that gap more? Can we build the percentage difference smaller between our visual cue response versus our auditory cue response? And then again, add another route on the map in our brain to make that happen. I think that that would be something that if somebody's listening right now and they've got a range that they're running, you know, taking lessons out of what you've spent 30 years plus doing, would be, it's a simple add. It's a simple fix. It doesn't cost anything. It maybe takes a little more time, maybe, but you're still running the same exact protocols. You're just slightly tweaking it so we can get a little bit closer to where we want everybody, which is what we're talking about here.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mike.
No, I was just going to say there's a lot. It's kind of funny. I say things like that, and then other people's brains predict that must mean I'm against that kind of training. I am not against that kind of training. I use that kind of training. I also train off Audible. I like competition shooting. I'm not for the extremes. That's my thing. If you say you're ready for a street fight because you're a professional boxer, it's not necessarily true. If you say you're ready for a street fight because you have a black belt in jiu-jitsu, that's not necessarily true. And if you say you're ready for a gunfight because you shoot competition and you can do this in 1 second, that's fantastic. But here is the problem in the real world. If you have a hostage situation, and let's say you have a sub 1 second draw and shoot center mass of target, your brain defaults, he's holding the hostage in front of him. You go, it's time to shoot. And your fear, anxiety, stress, and pressure climb at that moment when you draw that gun, then there's a good chance you're going to shoot center mass where you always shoot, and you're going to shoot the hostage. And we have video of it happening all the time. And then right there on the camera, you hear them go, oh, shit, what did I do? Why? Because your brain defaulted to what you did the most. And again, so I'm not against anything. What I'm against is the extremes. It's the I'm ready because I do this. It isn't enough because it's not representative. If you only train grappling, you're missing out on someone elbowing you, kneeing you, driving the hell out of you into the ground, bashing your head against the ground. If you only train boxing, then you get put on the ground. Oh shit, now we got a problem. And if you only train to shoot the gun, not to think with the gun in your hand and to make decisions about the gun, intelligent decisions about the gun, then you can run into some trouble. And that's where you send some rounds where they don't belong and an innocent person gets hit, or you empty the gun in 2 seconds and you don't hit a damn thing.
So with that said, Mike, let's talk a little bit about amygdala hijack. Cause we talk about it a lot during our trainings, and you know, you have a whole basic chapter on amygdala hijack alone, just discussing how important it is to understand it, right? And I always say, you know, I kind of make it very simple to say that the amygdala is basically your primal instinct. That's what causes you to just go right to your basic survival mode and to just act, you know, where your brain just shuts down and just the amygdala takes over and you just boom. React. So I just want to get into a little bit about the amygdala hijack and what you found through training and you know what you've seen with it.
So the amygdala hijack is it was the best way of putting it at the time, because it was the way a lot of people were using it. A lot of people in business were using it. So it was it became one of those things. Oh, I've heard of that before. So that's kind of why I used it. But what the amygdala hijack really is the amygdala isn't hijacking anything. What the amygdala is basically doing is saying, I don't think you're competent enough to do what you think you want to do. Therefore, I'm going to look for something faster for you. And it's not this rational thought thing. It's simple. It's neurons firing, associating the fastest association from all the senses that are coming in. Because what your brain does is predict your exterior world first. That's the most important thing to understand. Your brain doesn't wait to take information in. If your brain had to wait for that, our brain wouldn't fit in our head. We would need massive computational power. Instead, your brain predicts your exterior world, predicts your interior world, then waits for sense data and compares it. Whatever was not accounted for, whatever it did not predict, that is where your attention focuses. So when you are surprised, what ends up happening is something just occurred that was not predicted. Your brain is predicting it is about survival, and we are at the extremes. And when we are at the streams of valence and arousal, we're at that emotion of fear, anxiety, stress, and pressure. We are looking for the fastest associated response that survives the mechanism, not the conscious you, the mechanism that is you. And that's where you get, I shot the unarmed guy who I thought was going for a gun. I fired the gun empty in 2 seconds and didn't even realize it was empty. That's the amygdala basically saying, with all of our predictive mechanisms, you are not ready for prime time. We have nothing based on our past experience that shows you are ready for this. And because of that, we're going to take over and it's going to be extreme. It's not going to be very, there is no thought to it. It is fast, but not necessarily accurate. And it can be incredibly costly when you don't have the training on valence and arousal to have those predictions lower so that they're not at the extremes. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, for us, because we're all in this, it makes perfect sense to us. And I, the way you describe it, I have no doubt makes sense to anybody that might be freshly exposed to this. How was this received, if you can, at least within your department or other departments, maybe that you, not to put anybody on the spot as far as, you know, positive or negative reception, but, you know, how was this received as you're presenting this in real time while you're still, you know, prior to being retired, out on the street and trying to influence, you know, what's happening at the bottom of the pyramid in a respectful way, the patrol level, where the most officers are with the most engagements.
It was amazing when I first told people I'm going to talk to them for a little bit about neuroscience. And at first you see that look on their face of, you know, much like when you tell your dog to start licking himself and he does that kind of tilted head thing at you. But then what I was fascinated by was it took about maybe 15 minutes in and I start seeing people lean forward and I start seeing them kind of bounce in their seats a little bit. And then I'm like, I spoke for a couple more minutes and I'm like, any questions? And now I watch 20, 30, 40 hands go up and I'm like, okay, well, let's go with five. I'll keep going. And then I'll get five more and we'll get through this. And it was amazing to listen to them bring up a quick story and then go, are you saying that's what happened there? And I'm like, that's exactly what happened there. But it's easy for someone from the outside to go, oh, that's racism. Oh, that's hatred. Oh, I know that is, because their brain is trying to label it too. They're trying to use some logical thought process as to what that's happening. So when you explain that to people, that's where they're like, it was amazing to explain, because the whole gist was to explain implicit bias, what it really was, not what they were trying to present it as. And then to explain how that connected with training, it was the reception was awesome. People asked amazing questions, but then the next question was, all right, well, how do we train it? What do we have to do? And that's where you get into a little bit of the politics, because the politics comes up now. How much time is it going to take? How much money is it going to take? How often are they going to be off the street when we're 650 officers understaffed? What are our quicker solutions to this? And unfortunately, there isn't a quick solution to this, because we're trying to build up experience. So what you need is exposure. You don't need 4 hours of exposure, but you need increased exposure at smaller levels. And so that was the next thing was, well, how are we going to do that? And then we started, everybody wanted to study. So we looked into doing a neuroscience study. And then we were looking into how to take that science, apply it with training and just turn training on its head. But it always comes into the politics of how much money and how many personnel is it going to take to do this? And can we do it? And that's a whole different realm that I'm not very good at, other than explaining why we should.
Well, and I think that model proves itself too, when you look at our brothers and sisters that wear the shiny red hats, you know, firefighters, they train considerably more than they execute their job. And they are extremely proficient under stress because they train and train and train and train, and they don't drive around all day looking for fires. They're at, well, I mean, you know, my buddy Paul's usually sitting in the recliner thinking about the next meal he's going to cook, but they're constantly training, right? I'm obviously flipping him shit, but love him to death, but they're constantly training. And then when they do get the opportunity to go, they've got it down. They've got a protocol. Very rarely do you see complete and utter, you know, failures of job execution in the fire service. And you talk about training, flipping it on its head for law enforcement. Law enforcement is the exact opposite as far as time spent towards training, right? Hey, we're driving around looking for crime. Well, okay, that's not super efficient. It'd be just the same as if the firefighters were driving around the red trucks looking for fires. or in our area, you know, medical calls. But I don't think that it's all that hard to grasp the concept that what it takes is more time, more training, and quite frankly, more money, because this isn't cheap. Yeah. You know, we talk force on force and, you know, we kind of reference some things like Sims and things. It's expensive. You know, to be proficient at this, it costs a lot of money. It is extremely expensive because it's dangerous. I mean, it's hard to do the training. It's hard to do the training safely, and it's hard to replicate the training with all those factors in there. It is extremely expensive, and it's what we've experienced. And you know, if you can speak to this, I'd be really curious, because it's a whole different region. What we've experienced is that there are a lot of agencies, administrators, higher ups, you know, brass, politicians, they all want it. They all want it bad. But when it comes down to the line items and presentation in front of a city council or in front of the budgetary committee, training is kind of this squishy thing that doesn't, you know, a new shiny Bearcat or a new patrol SUV or a new whatever, that's a tangible item that the taxpayers can look, feel, touch, and see on the road every day. And what they don't see is the back end training behind the curtain. And for at least in our experience, that seems to be the biggest hurdle, is not so much that our admin and our brass aren't fully believing in this. It's that they just can't figure out a way to properly justify, or another way of saying it, sell it to the general public of, hey, this is why we spent $25 million on training last year and not, you know, a new fleet of cruisers.
Yeah. Well, the answer I give to a lot of, I've been blessed. I've been able to teach all over the world in the last couple of years, and traveling around the country and talking to people. The one thing that clicks, I think, the best when you're trying to explain it to people is, take your last five lawsuits and tell me how much money you paid out, and there's the money you need for your training. That's, because if you're getting sued less, you're going to have a lot more money available to you to fund your training. And if your training isn't reducing those lawsuits, then yeah, I highly suggest you look at why, what's going wrong with your training, that the decisions are leading to $30 million settlements and stuff like that. I understand the need politically to sell, you know, to settle for whatever, to make a lawsuit go away. But there are the ones where you lose, and you lose big. Those are the ones that we can fund training with by making sure that that stuff doesn't happen. And then the understanding, sometimes you just, yeah, it's hard, especially with politicians. When people are thinking politically, not necessarily about the right thing to do, not necessarily about the good thing to do, they're more worried about politics. That's a whole different realm. And I'll give you an example. Phoenix got a brand new, a brand new bear, but they were worried about it looking militaristic, so they painted it white.
Of course they did.
Oh my God.
I kid you not. So guys dressed in all black are getting out of a vehicle that glows in the dark white, and there's these little ants getting out of the vehicle. And we complained, and they're like, well, there's nothing you could do about it, because we're like, it looks like an ice cream truck. Kids are going to be running up to us looking for a cone. And it took a couple of years before someone finally said, how much does it cost to paint that thing? And it was a ridiculous amount of money. Paint it, please. For God's sakes, paint it. It's those things. And you know, and I get it. We all have a story about how crazy sometimes politics can be. And you're right. When it comes to training, that seems to be the one where it's a line item that they just don't want to increase. Everything else can increase in a budget, but that's the line item that seems to be a problem for some people. The big thing I think is just that, saying, okay, well, let's look at how much we're paying out in lawsuits, because that's probably one of the biggest expenditures that we have outside of the budget. So can we find some money there and donate it to training? And then when it comes, like you said, it's good to have police presence out there, but if you've got a double squad night, man, there's a couple agencies out there who are setting the bar where twice a month you must train. And I love it. I think it's great. There's an agency here, Paradise Valley. It's required. You train twice a month, and you will come off the street. Yeah. You're off the street training twice a month. That's so far ahead of its time. And you think about it and you're like, well, that just makes sense. But that is so far ahead of its time, because every other agency is talking about, oh, I just don't have enough people on the street. Well, is it quality or quantity? Do you just want butts in seats, or do you want people who can do this stuff? Because my theory is, if you train them for the 99, but they fall apart during the one, it's going to cost you a lot of money. If you train them for the one, the 99 is going to take care of itself, because the biggest problem we have is fear and anger that are two sides of the same coin. It's not the hatred. It's not the racism. It's fear. It's fear from lack of training. And then a 1% hits. If you're confident in the 1%, you're going to be confident all the time. And that allows you to be a nicer individual and not get scared about stuff.
Is it? I mean, I always see it, you know, with proper training, and it's a confidence builder, right? You know, when officers are truly trained well and get to a scene and they just, again, just kind of knock it out of the park, you know, we see it all the time. And you can tell the huge difference. Now, I mean, the most recent, right? We'll touch on this real quick. You know, look at the difference between Uvalde response and, you know, Tennessee Metro PD response with those active shooters. You have a group of four cops in Tennessee that just knew what they were doing. They flowed, they moved, and you can tell the training that they've had. You can tell how they were moving, how they communicate with each other with just simple body language, not even verbal, but just their body language. You can see how they flowed through that hallway and took down the shooter. And then, you know, go to the other extreme, you know, a place like Uvalde, where they didn't do the training and it showed. And the confusion and all that things that happened during Uvalde. And, you know, I always use those two as a stark reminder of what it's like when you have four cops that are trained and 300 cops that are not, and the difference between how they responded. And you know, what you talk about in your book, and even bringing this training to your department to Phoenix. I know we spoke a little earlier, but we'll touch on it too. When you went to implement it in your department, when you started to, was there buy-in by the administration?
There was buy-in for the neuroscience, making sure that the neuroscience was in. There was buy-in that we needed to up our training. But the problem again was we were 650 officers understaffed, and we were having some extreme budgetary problems. And then we also had the DOJ thing. So we had to be ready to divert a lot of money to that, because it costs a lot of money to send all of the stuff that they're requiring. So that kind of put a hamper on a lot of things. And the cool thing was, it was a great working relationship. It wasn't that anyone said, no, that's just stupid. It's everybody wanted to do it. The next question was, all right, how are we going to do it under budgeted? How are we going to do it understaffed? What are some of the things we can do? And Phoenix is really good about always trying to find the best high quality training they can. They're really good about that. But it was within working within those constraints, and those constraints, they bound us up pretty good. I mean, I'm not going to lie, it set us back a little bit.
So for those that are listening, we want to be respectful of your time here, because I mean, you have a really high hourly rate with what you offer, and it's free for everyone listening. There's some legitimate next level education that, you know, we're just touching the surface of. Other than the two book, you know, Taming the Serpent and Fall 7, Rise 8, which, if I'm correct, they're available everywhere. I mean, I got mine on the bookstore and you know, read it from my phone, but Amazon, Barnes & Noble, they're everywhere. You've got your website, you've got your Instagram handle. Where can people find you, and what would be the one thing that you would want everybody to take home with them today if they're going back to, you know, even if they're going on the job tonight, like one thing that they can take before shift, you know, like kind of pre-visualize before going to work and just be maybe 1% better tonight after listening to this?
One of the things that you can do, which is probably one of the most crazy discoveries in the last 5 years, is we had talked earlier about box breathing. Box breathing is great for getting on an even keel, taking your time to recover. It's great for that. But if you've heard of the physiological sigh, I don't want to bore you with the science about it, but we do it in our sleep. Sometimes our carbon dioxide levels get too high. There's a trigger in the brain, and you will do a double inhale and an exhale. And when you do that double inhale and the exhale, it causes you to flip the switch to parasympathetic response, and you offload carbon dioxide. a high buildup of carbon dioxide causes panic and anxiety. People who have a panic attack are having that buildup of carbon dioxide in their system. Even your dog does it while he's sleeping. You'll hear the dog inhale twice and exhale. If you are going to something and you are fearful, or you're in a pursuit, you could feel it, your heart is hammering in your chest, and you're starting to feel like you might be losing control, and hopefully you're smart enough to realize that, 3, 4, 5 of those physiological sighs can drastically bring you back into control. And now as you're teaching your brain to stay in control, hopefully in the future, your brain starts to predict less valence and arousal. And now you start to feel like you have more of those higher order rules available to you. So the easiest way to do physiological sigh is 2 in through the nose, 1 out through the mouth. If you can't, if your nose is blocked or you have a banged up nose like mine, and you can only do it through one nostril, do it. But if you can also do it through the mouth, it is quicker. 2 in through the nose, 1 out through the mouth. So it would be like this. Brings down your blood pressure, brings down your heart rate. It offloads that carbon dioxide, and that gives you a better sense of control. Because when carbon dioxide levels go up, it is going to be that amygdala striatum connection where you're going to look for those fast, quick responses, panicky responses. And that's one of the better tools you can use right now and start using for the people who are like, well, I am afraid, man. I'm working and I'm getting into situations that scare the hell out of me. Start using that tool. And then away from work, start using the box breathing to recover. Because remember, your brain can only predict from the baseline that it's at. So let's say you had an argument with your significant other. You're on your way to work and they call and they said, hey, your kid's jammed up at school. Then your boss calls you and say, hey, dude, that arrest you made last night on that traffic stop, we got a use of force complaint from you. Your baseline on valence and arousal is supposed to be here. Now it's a couple of degrees higher than that. Then you go to your first call and it's something so horrific done to a child. You cannot even imagine that someone could do this. And now your valence and arousal are through the roof. You are feeling highly emotional. The next call is a homeless guy who is trying to push your buttons and it doesn't take much to put them and you go off. That is so vital to understand that you can only predict from where you're at. Your brain doesn't recover completely. The only way for it to recover completely is for you to aid it in recovering completely. If not, it just keeps predicting that you need more, 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 more valence, more arousal. And now you're making predictions from a place where common sense is not common. It's just not there for you. So that would probably be the most important lesson I think you could immediately start using to your benefit.
Mike, that's so huge. I mean, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And you know, for all the officers that are listening, going out to work tonight, please listen to this. Your webpage has got all kinds of resources available. When you got downtime, you know, combativeresolutions.com, your Instagram account, Michael G. Malpass. You've got so much information out there that's free. I mean, yes, you know, please buy the book because both books are well worth the read. And I know that you're not somebody that's hard to get a hold of either. You know, we would just really like to encourage everybody to reach out to you because there's so much more to this. I mean, we could take 10 hours and barely scratch the surface, but I cannot thank you enough, especially for what time you've given us, but also just the knowledge. I mean, it's such a huge thing. You were so far ahead of your time before you even realized it, you know, in the 80s. Now taking that and translating that to what our youth and our newer officers and even our, you know, long in the tooth guys like that guy's sitting there on the other screen. We all can learn something from it and get better. We just can't thank you enough. I mean, it is so appreciative of the time.
Thank you so much, Mike, for taking time to speak to a couple knuckle draggers here, about, this stuff. And man, if you could just hang out just for a minute, we're just going to, do an outro here and then we will, talk to you a little bit more. All right.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, man.
I mean, there you go. I mean, that's a big bar for episode one of this season. Big guest, big time. Super pumped for that. I am beyond my brain. I want to go decompress for like the next 2 hours. I can't wait for it. It's going to be so awesome. What would not be possible without the help of all of our supporters and partners, AAA Police Supply. Check them out at AAAPoliceSupply.com. Use that code HYBRID10 for 10% off every order that you make. Our good friends over at Havoc Journal and the Havoc podcast partners in the Profiles in Havoc podcast over there, the Second Mission Foundation and the 22 Mohawks group as well. as our friend Kyle Lamb and Viking Tactics. Check out all of the highest quality battle-proven tactical gear at vikingtactics.com. And of course, our good friends over at the Overwatch Project, overwatchproject.org. You can get more information on how to form workable plans of action for you, your buddies, and how to just fucking ask. Huge, huge thanks to all of our partners and sponsors and our supporters. Iman, brother, coming out of the gates hot, buddy. We got a lot to live up to now.
Hell yeah, man. All right, everybody, stay safe, stay sapient. We'll be right back.